Our last speaker is Allison Banger, and the title is Integrating Health Information Exchange with Disaster Preparedness and Response.
Morning and welcome, everyone. I hope you braved Market Street this morning. I was kind of shocked when I walked over here at 7 o'clock this morning that there were people who were already annoyed at me for trying to cross the street because I thought I was trying to cut in front of them for their spot for the parade. welcome. Just a brief word of introduction about myself. I work with RTI, a nonprofit health research organization. I've been working in the health IT and health information exchange space for the last almost 6 years now. And there's been a lot going on during that time, and I'll give a little bit of context for where we've been and where we're going here. Couple of brief disclaimers. Neither Stephanie, Bob, or I have any financial conflicts to disclose. And then I would also mention that this work was funded by the Department of Health and Human Services through the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, and the views in this presentation do not represent, not necessarily represent those of HHS or ONC. So our key takeaways from the presentation this morning, I'm going to talk a little bit about health information exchange in general, just to sort of catch everybody up. When I've given this talk before, we've had a mix of, or given information about this project before, when we have a mix of audiences, people on the health information exchange side and the emergency preparedness side, so I'm going to give a little bit of context for both of those. So whichever side you're coming from, hopefully you'll have the baseline you need to see what's going on here. I'm going to talk about the project that was used by the Search Consortium, which is the particular group that executed this work to develop solutions for interstate exchange during disaster recovery and response. And then identify potential overlap between Emergency Support Function 8, which is one of 15 emergency support functions that are deployed during disaster response and recovery, and HIE, and how this can really be leveraged to improve patient care. Just a brief note on HIE. I have a habit of using it as both a verb and a noun, so you'll hear it both ways. The verb, it's the actual act of exchanging information between providers, whether that's within or across healthcare organizations. You'll also hear it as a noun, which is the organization that facilitates that exchange. So just a word of, if you get stuck on that, it's one of the great existential questions in our field. Is it a noun or a verb? And then briefly, what are the emergency support functions? As I said, there's 15 of them, and this first bullet should be quoted since it's from a CDC publication, but just so you know, they're the functions needed to save lives, protect property and the environment, restore essential services and critical infrastructure, and to help victims and communities return to normal after a disaster. And the one that we're focusing on today is ESF-8, which is Public Health and Medical Services. At the federal level, it's coordinated by Health and Human Services via the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, and they provide support to state, local, and tribal jurisdictions. And this really covers the provision of medical services, surveillance, and patient movement. And just sort of for context, some of the other ESFs relate to transportation, hazmat recovery, basically anything that you can think of falls under one of those 15 categories. So as I said in my introduction, health IT has come a long way. Really at the federal level, support for health IT and health information exchange began in 2004 when President Bush II issued an executive order calling for all Americans to have an electronic health record by 2014. We're not going to get there, but we're much further along than we were. And that also results in the creation of the Office of the National Coordinator. In 2008, we had 17% of physicians in ambulatory practices with an EHR. And by 2012, we're up to almost half. And this big intervening event in the middle is the 2009 the stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which included the HITECH Act as part of it, which is the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act. And that included a number of cooperative agreement programs and other contracts to really support implementation of EHRs and health information exchange, including the state HIE cooperative agreements, the regional extension centers, which support providers in adopting EHRs, the Beacon communities, which are supposed to be the exemplars of organizations and communities that are doing it right, and then the Medicare and Medicaid EHR incentive programs, which dispense funding to providers who meet meaningful use, and meaningful use is meaningful use of electronic health records. If you're not familiar with that concept, it's a big thing at the moment. You can always read the notice of proposed rulemaking if you're feeling like you don't have enough excitement in your life. So this particular project is run by RTI, which is our organization under the auspices of ONC, through a project called the State Health Policy Consortium. And there are a number of projects that we support under this umbrella. I think, Stephanie, we have to 8, 9. And they address a number of issues, the goal being to have small consortia of states that come together to solve a specific information exchange challenge. And this one happened to be focused on disaster preparedness and response. So our participants in this particular group, and SEARCH is the Southeastern Regional Consortium, and the H is escaping me at the moment, but it included representatives from Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, basically the Gulf states with the exception of Mississippi. And this particular group of states, as you can probably imagine, has a vested interest. There's a lot of instances in which your neighbor's disaster is your disaster too, because you're dealing with either providing additional support services or you've got people coming into your state as a result of disasters in other areas. So the overall goals of this particular project were to develop a strategic plan for sharing health information in the Southeast and Gulf states during and following a declared natural disaster, to identify legal gaps and obstacles, to understand the current technical approaches and how that might impact recommendations and plans moving forward, and to really identify opportunities for creating regional exchange. This is just a brief summary of our approach. I will note we did a literature scan to sort of see what was already out there, a legal analysis and a technical analysis, and then the synthesis is really what you're seeing there. One of the big sets of lessons came out of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and it's kind of amazing how far we are removed from those and yet how little of these recommendations have been implemented. But there was a lot, there were many patients who were left without access to their medical records during those hurricanes. You had people showing up with paper bags of medications where all of the pills had dissolved and all of the labels had been washed off. And there were some ad hoc solutions that were stood up, particularly around prescription drug information, to help people get the care that they needed at a time when everything was underwater. And some of these key lessons included a need for advanced planning, improvement of communication strategies, and to leverage existing resources. One thing that they noted is that it's important to still protect the privacy and security of health information. We don't want to compromise that just because we understand that there may be accommodations, but we still want to ensure that we're respecting the rights of individuals there. To ensure access to health data outside the immediate disaster zone, so that when people are displaced, they can still access their health information, and to understand these interstate policy barriers that might prevent exchange across state lines. So just briefly, as I said, we looked at legal issues, technical issues, and then this third issue of governance was one that really sort of emerged within the group. We had a fortuitous meeting with someone who himself has more of a disaster preparedness background and was really able to help us flesh this out properly. So addressing privacy and security, looking at the different technical models that are currently in place, and then bringing in the governance piece, looking at the ESF8 agency within each state and how they can lead, help lead and govern these areas as well. Currently, I'm going to just run through this quickly. There's a mix of health information exchange models being deployed at different, and there are different stages of development across the states, and that's true within SEARCH and nationally. There's limited cross-border data exchange taking place at the moment. We've got regional examples where you've got a city, for example, that's near a border, and they tend to do a better job there out of necessity, but broadly speaking, it's quite limited. The projected volume of clinical data available is dependent on rates of health IT adoption and participation in broader exchange, and as I said, that's increasing rapidly, so we do expect that there'll be more information available for exchange. And then there are significant variations in how states approach authorization or the consent to disclose information that impacts access to records. Just to summarize some of the legal issues, we have HIPAA. HIPAA sets the privacy floor, and many states have additional restrictions beyond that that need to be addressed. And some states do have dispensation for declared emergencies, but some don't. And so there are still privacy and security restrictions in place that need to be respected. There are other federal laws that get us into sticky situations regarding, and state laws in particular, and those often address sensitive health topics such as behavioral health, substance abuse, reproductive health, and other sensitive information. This one I'm going to skip because it's sort of a repeat. With regards to governance, there really has to be somebody in charge. And what we realized is that there's nobody in charge, and that was really one of the challenges when it comes to exchanging this health information, that the HIE people are doing their thing and the disaster preparedness people are doing their thing, and there really hasn't been a convergence there in terms of how those organizations could work together to really prepare for a future event. And this summarizes the overall response framework that we're dealing with here and the deployment. So some overall trends, and I've mentioned a couple of these previously. Both the use of EHRs and PHRs, which are personal health records maintained by the patient, is likely to increase over the next several years, giving us a richer base of data. The question is going to be how we bring that data together and are able to share it to coordinate patient care. Increased implementation of cloud-based EHRs. Right now, most of them are, you know, we have servers in offices. As more people switch to a cloud-based model, that gives us more options. If you're in Alabama and your server is in Nevada, it's less of an issue than if your server is in your basement and your basement's in a floodplain. And then HIE projects are taking both push and pull approaches that are changing the overall capabilities of health information exchange as we use it on a day-to-day basis. So both the pull, where I go and I say, I need information about this person, and the push, and they say, you have this person or you have this population, here's information for you. Given the variability across the states, the group has suggested a phased approach in terms of leveraging existing data sources, seeing how they can be integrated. And this would include both the data from electronic health records, personal health records, and then claims data and other clinical data sources. And to use direct secure messaging, and direct is it's a set of protocols for securely exchanging information. The best way I've heard it described is it's like email, in the sense that if you have a Yahoo account or a Gmail account, it doesn't matter, we can still exchange, but there are the protocols that underlie it. So it's the protocols rather than the platform for exchanging secure messages. And then to enable cross-border exchange by implementing authentication services for physicians and patients. How do we know who somebody is, who they say they are? So there were five recommendations that emerged from this work specifically. The first one is to understand your state's disaster response policies and how the ESF-8 agency functions within the state. And I think I looked through these this morning. I'm pretty sure most of them have the before a disaster occurs. So we're really hoping that folks will sort of take this as an opportunity as they're building out their HIE capabilities to bring in the emergency preparedness aspect. To develop standard procedures approved by the relevant public and private stakeholders to share electronic health information across state lines, and bringing the folks into the room who really have a vested interest, and that will include clinicians, patients, and other advocacy organizations as well. And this one's a little bit lengthy, but one of the options for addressing the legal variability is to implement an MOU. As I said, HIPAA is a floor when it comes to privacy, and basically suggesting that there's an option to default to HIPAA and when we've got a declared disaster. There's also something called the DIRSA, which is the Data Use and Reciprocal Support Agreement, which may also help to address privacy, security, and other health data sharing concerns. The fourth is to really understand what's going on in your state and the ability to currently share information. Most states have done this as part of some of the cooperative agreements that they have with the federal government to help build agent capacity, but to really understand what the resources are available to you. And then to consider a phased approach. Since the states are in a wide degree of variability with how far along they are in implementation, it may be necessary to take interim steps to bring that data in before the entire system is up and running. So in conclusion, the collaborative effort points to a method for developing multi-state policy, particularly among neighboring states, although there's no reason it couldn't be expanded more broadly. We've addressed the issue of patient authorization and offered a potential solution for emergency access to patient records following a disaster. There's an actionable plan within there for states to move ahead with integrating the disaster preparedness work with their state-level health information exchange planning. And then really this ESF 8 part of it, which as I said was something that sort of surprised us as we moved forward with this project. Most of us, including myself, came at it from a health information exchange background rather than a preparedness background. And understanding this part of it was a key part to developing recommendations that would be widely useful. So the search report is available. I've given you the link here to the healthit.gov website. Otherwise, it would be a direct link to the PDF. So you're welcome to take a look. There's an awful lot of detail in there about our process, our findings, and our recommendations. There's more information about the State Health Policy Consortium in general, rti.org/shpc. The next steps for this group would be some pilot testing around this particular issue, and then outreach and dissemination for further information to stakeholders both in the HIE communities and in the preparedness community as well. Benjamin Franklin. I'd like to acknowledge a variety of folks who helped out with this particular project. John Rancourt and Lee Stevens are our project officers at ONC. The second bullet is all of the folks at the state level. Particularly like to acknowledge Sam Shafton and Christopher Sullivan for their work on this particular project. We're funded under that very long contract number there at the bottom as well. And there's my contact information, and I think we're in good shape on time in terms of questions for either me or for anybody else. So thank you very much.
Are there any questions for any of the panelists? Yes.
I have a couple of questions, so I'll just do one and wait for another turn. For the Veterans Administration plan, you had the four phases there at the end, which is an extra last slide. Have you implemented that anywhere, or how are you still in the development?
So no, that's a recommendation. So I wrote a report was written for reporting the results of the study. And those are recommendations that I indicated. And I don't know if there are discussions about implementing them, but we're still in sort of the planning phase of that.
Okay. Any other questions? How practical is it for a small shop to start experimenting with patient-based modeling? It's something that we've talked a lot about, but the requirements of programming, and I know there's some solutions out there, but what does it take to make that happen? And as far as your decision trees are, when you bring in the social data, are you weighting things differently, or how does that work when you're bringing in the social data?
Start off on that one, and then I might turn that one over to my father for the feasibility part. But in terms of the behavior module, the options were chosen for probability distribution. So there's a certain probability of reuniting, and another probability of evacuating, and so on. And then that was chosen at each time step where a behavior was chosen. And in terms of implementing agent-based models, I think on the ground level, like a sort of basic implementation,
I mean, it's reasonably straightforward. What we're excited about is that we've been in this field for a little while, and we sort of changed the way that we organize this thing, and it allowed us to bring in a lot of disparate data sources, and also allowed for folks like myself, I did the health side, Caitlin and Mark did a bunch of the behavior side of things, and allowed us to sort of develop in parallel instead of trying to stack everything on top of each other, which is sort of a standard way of doing agent-based modeling. Now that we've sort of built up something like this, we are looking for more and more partners also to sort of address relevant questions. You know, NPS1 was sort of chosen just because it's NPS1, sort of the most sort of aggressive sort of scenario to plan for, and we wanted to sort of challenge the ability to represent that, but I'd be glad to talk to you afterwards about other problems you might want to use that, this type of technology.
I had a question about the data for Allison. You know, you ended with not only the answers change to other questions that you ask. I'm curious if, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't
mean to. Oh, I was like, I don't think this has anything to do with my presentation.
I'm looking at her and I'm looking at your name up there. So
that's fine.
I apologize. I'm talking to Dr. Rivers. Okay, sorry. So anyway, I'm thinking about all the East Coast disasters that just now happened, and I'm wondering what it would be like to go back now and ask you, because your questions are going to change so much as you evaluate all of that. And the models that you're presenting plug in what has happened and evaluate and see what might be different. So yeah, is that something that you're thinking would already about doing?
Right, exactly. I mean, a lot of the issue oftentimes is that we don't have very good historical records for these complex incidences, emergencies, catastrophes, however you want to phrase it. And yeah, that is an idea if we want to set up a better. I was actually at a conference last week in Pittsburgh where it was sort of disaster preparedness one, and they're talking about building better technology to gather the kind of information that we could then show through these kinds of simulations and sort of play these what if scenarios, like what if, you know, we had been able to get sandbags on the battery in time, kind of thing, to prevent some of the flooding in the subways or some of that kind of thing. So yeah, that's exactly what these sort of simulation platforms are for. So play out these different scenarios and sort of, you know, prepare yourself to look at that and measure impact.
Because you've got so many of the what ifs answered, what if this happens, then you can go back and look at that. How would you do it differently? Or?
Right. And it's also good for hypothesis generation. Like if you look back at sort of the, what it does is sort of creates more information that actually exists. Now, whether it's realistic or not is a valid question, but it can create situations that may or may not arise in future disasters, unless you can at least have some contingencies by being able to analyze it where anecdotally you might not have captured that when, you know, the actual disaster happened.
And I know that where the technology is right now, these kinds of simulations to this level of detail take a very long time to prepare. But we saw with epidemic simulations, which is also something our lab is involved with, it starts out as being very time intensive to get it off the ground, but as the technology progresses, we might be able to run these things like almost real time or something like that. It's hard to tell like where we'll be able to end up, but right now implementing something with Sandy would probably take a really long time, but hopefully we'll be able to progress that.
Any other questions? I had one question for Caitlin about the extent to which you considered the win in terms of the plume for nuclear-oriented explosions.
That data came from another. We basically implemented the data, but we didn't generate the wind plume data.
Right, so the part of the technology like step up that we did to support this was that, yeah, we had some folks at the Department of Defense whose job it is to, like, they just love blowing things up and making plumes and figuring that all out. And they have very complicated models for all of this where they take urban canyoning into effect so that buildings sort of funnel it down so you have a building that's like 20 blocks away and it gets damaged by that wind because it just sort of rushes down the street. So that was all sort of incorporated into it, and by developing this like highly detailed synthetic data platform, we're able to just sort of say, okay, building at this address has this damage, building at this address has this damage, and just bring that in from other players who have more expertise than us. Like we don't want to know how to make plumes and all that. So yeah, the wind on, I think it was May 15th at 11:15 a.m. was actually used to generate how that plume would blow out, and then carried over time and sort of drifted out over Maryland. It even ended up touching the tip of poor New Jersey, which has suffered enough after Sandy here.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we've concluded. We can give a final round of applause.